Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Larimer, and today I'm joined by Ms. Sarah Gahn. Sarah, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thanks, Nick.
And Mr. Becky Mohlobo. Becky, how are you doing, sir?
Doing well in yourself, Nick. Hi, Sarah.
How's it?
I'm doing all right, thank you very much. So we do apologize, we're going to have various sort of sound problems today. Becky is just unfortunately having some technical problems, and Sarah has been the victim of crime, and so all of her tech is missing because it was stolen, and so we are unable to get great sound from her side, but we shall not let the voice of liberty die despite the adversity it faces. we're also sorry for being a little bit late for those watching live. Becky was recording another show, and it got delayed a little bit. So let us dive into the stories of today. And the big one is a great article that has been written by economist Mike Schussler about South Africa's manufacturing sector. So the headline that I saw for this article was "The Country Manufacturing, the Destruction of SA Manufacturing is South Africa." And Schussler goes on at length to talk about just the problems we've had with our manufacturing sector and how poorly it has done, not just sort of in absolute terms, but compared to the rest of the world. And this is, I think he brings out some really great data points here, which I think really show the position that we're in. So our industrial sector, our manufacturing sector has been pretty heavily regulated. Ministers like Ibrahim Patel have had, shall we say, a lot of ideas and a lot of policies to try and boost our manufacturing. But based on Schussler's article here, they seem to have been very counterproductive. There's been, I think, an industrial policy action plan produced by the Department of Trade and Industry every single year for the last 16 years. And yet, there are now fewer people employed in formal manufacturing than in 1969, when the population was much, much smaller. There are some other statistics here. South Africa is only one of 13 economies in the world that is now producing less than a decade ago. There are some other big countries in that pile, but they're not particularly well-governed ones, those being Brazil and Russia. And just on average, we seem to have taken a bit of a hit, even compared to other African countries. So, Becky, you have some thoughts on this. You've just given a spiel on this. Why don't you enlighten us? What should we think about this? Have I left things out? How are we doing compared to the rest of Africa?
The picture is quite dire, Nick. South Africa is actually a train outlier when you compare us to other countries, especially emerging markets. Even coming after the 2020 hard lockdown levels and the nonsensical lockdown measures that we saw as of last year, we've added about 1.7 million people to the expanded rate of the number of people unemployed under the expanded definition, which includes discouraged work seekers. That translates to a labor absorption of about 37.7%, far lower than that of emerging markets at 60%. So South Africa is just past the halfway line of what we see in other emerging markets. And this speaks to the point that really policymakers seem to miss, that policies should be judged by the outcome, not by the intent, because the intent of the policies that we've seen over the last 10 years have been hostile to the South African economy and has led to a decline in social economic factors in the country. And another thing that is often missed by policymakers is that we speak about these people losing their jobs and so forth, but these are people losing their incomes. They aren't able to sustain themselves and their families. And when you put minimum wages faced with 75% youth unemployment levels, that is just utter recklessness, Nick. It's actually unbelievable the thinking that we see in policymakers in the country.
So, Sarah, one of the things that really struck me here is actually how South Africa has done compared to some other African countries. So there were the three countries. There was a graph in this article. I think we'll put it in the description because it's worth reading, which showed a percentage of the workforce engaged in manufacturing of various countries around the world, and it compared us to three African countries as well. And those countries were Nigeria, Egypt, and Ethiopia. And now, if you know anything about how those countries kind of shake out, you know, they're not very politically stable. They have terrorist bombings. Ethiopia's had a civil war. And yet, they're doing better in manufacturing than we are. In fact, as Mike Schussler put it, South Africa is no longer the most industrialized country in Africa. How could that possibly be the case?
I think it's fairly simple. What you have is a government that's been in power for a long time, and the policies it's put in place. And you know, people keep talking about, you know, a slow pace of reform, and yeah, but it's being hampered by. It's not a slow pace of reform. It's the pace of no reform as we would consider it to be reform whatsoever. So all that's happening is, in fact, it's everything is happening that is making it more difficult for people to create businesses. And those businesses are then the businesses you want to manufacture things and sell them locally and internationally. I think the problem is that with the fixation of the move to socialism, which really still imbues almost every aspect of the ANC, they tend to forget that they are not the best people to drive the creation of business. They do not know what we need. The people who know what we need or think they can sell us something that we will want or need are the people who are on the ground able to do business. And that's the private sector. That is not the government sector. What the government sector should be doing is, as I think is mentioned in the article, it should be repairing our transport system, particularly trains. I mean, you should be getting trucks off the road, big heavy trucks off the road. Coal shouldn't be transported by road. You've got lines are not working in urban areas where people used to use it as transport to get to work. Those lines are not working. So that's what the government should be doing. It's not telling us what should be made. They should be saying, what do you want to make? What can we do for you? You say, well, I need a railway line that's outside our front door working. That's what the government should be doing. But it's part of that sort of arrogance and paternalism that a government who's aiming at socialism shows the rest of society. They don't know what we need. All they need to do is get out of our lives more, which means cutting what we have humongous amounts of red tape, making things quicker and simpler, and just providing us with the basics that make it easier for us to do our jobs. They are public servants, not the other way around. And for them to say, no, well, you know, we should be selling less chickens because we're getting more. We should be selling more chickens because we're getting less. You know, by and large, if the market will fill the space, and it is not for the government to tell us how to do it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's funny you say cut red tape, because another person who's been saying that recently at a economic growth forum is Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana, who said that one of the things that he will hope to do as South African finance minister is indeed cut red tape. Becky, is there much credibility to that claim? What do you make of what the finance minister has been saying in regards to improving the economic situation?
Honestly, Nick, I wouldn't put much substance to what the current financial minister said. Reason being is that the ANC likes to portray itself as a reformist government. I mean, that's the run-of-the-mill cliche argument that Cyril Ramaphosa makes, is that he's a reformer, or rather the media projects him to be a reformer. But in order to be a reformist government, you need to have the inclinations for reform. It means admitting when you're wrong, admitting that over the past 10 years, you've just implemented policies that have not resulted in high levels of economic growth, that have resulted in the destruction of the manufacturing sector, as we've spoken about earlier, Nick, as well as that of overall employment in the country and living standards. So what we see from the current financial minister is really fidgeting around the edges. Remove red tape. We need to reform the electricity sector and so forth. And nothing really of substance, nothing to say that we need the complete scrapping of EWC, the complete scrapping of BEE, and rather look at the social economic standing of the disadvantaged rather than that of the skin color. The removing of minimum wages, as well as other redistributive policies that don't amount to much in the country.
And Yeah, that's exactly right. And I want to take aim, Sarah, obviously, you know, get your thoughts on any plans for reform. But I also want to get your take on what I think is the thing that enables this fidgeting around the edges and this lack of changing of course. And that is, of course, something we've gone on about a lot in the show, which is businesses' response. So at the same conference, some of the business leaders in attendance said things like, well, you see, the problem isn't policy. It's just implementation. Government's got all the right ideas. We just haven't implemented them well. Are they right?
I don't think this is the appropriate place for me to slip my wrists, but they're either lying or they're stupid or they're desperate or they're all of the above. Because, yes, government implementation by and large is pretty bad all around, but their policies are wrong. I mean, we do badly because they implement bad policy. And the problem, of course, is that good policy would actually mean removing their hands from the economy more and more. And what I find fascinating with the business sector, big business sector, is, you know, they're always soft on the ANC. They're always, afraid they'll lose business or they're powerful people. And, you know, if the sort of 10 years of Jacob Zuma and 4 years of Cyril Ramaphosa hasn't seen the reform we need, so we've just literally slid off every index that is imaginably possible. I mean that figure you gave of 1969, you know, people employment in the sector. I mean, this government should be so ashamed of that. But you can't. As I say, even if the best thing you can do with the current policy is not implement anything, because the policy is poor. And if the business sector is afraid of losing, I don't know how, you know, government is going to take revenge on them. I'd be interested to know what it is exactly they're afraid of. But they've got that is completely arse about face.
Well said. Becky, any final thoughts before we move on to our next topic?
No, nothing much more to add to what Sari has said. I just don't see that the current administration implementing any forms of reform. And any measure they have implemented in terms of would lean that way towards a reformist mindset, they had to be pressured to do so, such as the increase of to 100 megawatts by private procurers in the electricity sector. So unfortunately, the simple truth of the matter is that Ramaphosa is simply not a reformer. And a point that I actually like to highlight mostly here is that where could South Africa could have been if we actually grew the economy, if we grew at 3 to 5%, if we increased the number of people employed, if these families got an income to sustain themselves and their family members. I mean, constantly the number one issue that we see in our polling data since 2001 is that the most pressing issue that South Africans face on a daily basis is that of unemployment and jobs. And then at the bottom of that list is those redistributive policies that are implemented by the ANC. So we can clearly see that the policies being implemented by the ANC are not aligned with what the average South African wants.
No, exactly. And I think that really is the thing here. As long as expropriation without compensation sits at the heart of government's economic policy plan, there's not a single thing that you can take seriously when they talk about improving the business environment. It is like a giant shotgun aimed at the heart of the country's economy. And if they get rid of EWC, if say it fails in Parliament in a few weeks or months, and it's never brought up again, then maybe you can start to talk about some serious efforts to reform the economy. But until then, no luck. Anyway, let us move on to, shall we say, a contributing factor to the economic malaise that we find ourselves in. And that is South Africa's very high dropout rate. So anyone who's kind of looked at education data in South Africa will know that one of the reasons not to take our matric pass rate that seriously as an indicator of the quality of the education in the country is because of the enormous number of students who drop out before they even get to matric. Very large numbers of kids actually, and about grade 10 or so, grade 9, when it starts to become legal to drop out, just sort of drop out of the education system, and they either look for work or they live off of some kind of benefit, or they, you know, just do what they can to get by. They hustle, so to speak. And President Cyril Ramaphosa was speaking to teachers recently he was speaking at the 21st National Teaching Awards, and he said that teachers needed to do more to try and get South Africa's dropout rate in schools lower. He said that he was going to challenge teachers to get South Africa's dropout figure under 25%. He said, quote, "You should walk the streets of our townships, the pathways of our villages. Go hunt them down and ask them why they are not in the classroom. If they leave school, you must find out why. Is it because you are boring and not exciting?" He then basically just went on to say that, you know, we need to, as a society, do more to make sure that kids stay in school. And this really got under my skin because it's almost as though he's kind of saying that the fact that a lot of kids drop out of school is some sort of moral failing on the part of South Africa and teachers. Sarah, what do you make of what the president said?
You know, he's very good at this. If you read almost anything he writes or, recordings of his speeches, he somehow either casts a problem as being caused by a third party, or if it's caused by the ANC, it is happening as if no one's responsible for it. And that's a
passive voice is abused, yes, a lot.
It's a sort of passive voice thing. One of the problems is, I mean, the disaster in the education system started a long time ago because the wrong policies, again, were put in place. And an emphasis was placed on matric and the beauty of going into university or getting into university. And I can understand the aspiration of that. But the problem is twofold. One is the emphasis had to be at the very beginning. Pre-primary, primary school, that's where the emphasis has to be. And it's taken way too long to get back to that point, because that will lead to better outcomes. But if you start where the outcomes are and you haven't dealt with the preceding years, you're in trouble. And that's partly the problem, is that you'll have a lot of kids, they can leave school after grade 9, who may not be doing terribly well, so they will leave school after grade 9. But let's go to the teaching or the education sector, and that is the fact that in order to overcome what could look like an appalling pass rate in matric, the schools make quite a lot of effort to get kids out of the school before they get to that point, so that the figures don't look worse than they are. And of course, once the kids get out, I mean, I think one of the biggest problems, it's always been a problem, and I think it's even bigger now, is there's absolutely no sense for kids of what jobs, what sort of work is out there, what they might be appropriate to try and seek, where they can go and seek training, et cetera, et cetera. So they do opt out, or they get sort of pushed out of the system. And they don't necessarily know where they should go or who to go to. And it's again the problem of, it's not a matter of the teachers not just, of course it's a matter of the teachers not putting out, but it's about good input from the word go. And that's about restructuring the education system and the policies that go with education. And 27 years on, we're trying, a lot of damage is done in the early years. Outcomes-based education, everyone who wasn't in government knew it would be a disaster, which it was. So the education system is a mess. And one of the messes is that it doesn't cater for the fact that a lot of kids are going to drop out of school before matric, and are going to need to find a way to learn and be trained so that they can be employed despite not having a trick. And we all know that having a matric means very little. You have to be trained into something and gain experience to be of any value. It is, and it always has been.
Becky, Sarah, I think, has just laid out a really good analysis of the reasons in education policy that have led to the situation. But obviously there's also economic stuff as well. What, from an economic side, what do you think government could do to try and, you know, reduce the dropout rate?
From the economic side, is this simply get out of the way of businesses. Allow businesses to hire people. And the reason why I say this is that people also learn through employment. They can upskill themselves and they get an income and then they get experience and they can earn more. This is just what we see in other countries as well. It's just scrap minimum wages, implement a voluntary contract. A thing that I see within the ANC is that they're very good at deflection. If there are riots on the streets because people are hungry, there's enormous amounts of poverty levels in the country, largely due to policies that they implement. It's due to because of its 12 people that was trying to overcome the government and so forth. And in this particular case, it's the teachers as well as the South Africans. Not the fact that we have certain schools in the country that don't have proper ceiling, that don't have proper facilities for education, and about 4.5% of South Africans only pass mathematics with a pass mark of 50% and above. That's largely due to the government's fault. And if you don't allow those people to upskill themselves, a person that goes to university, a person that gets an opportunity to go to university, which unfortunately is so few due to the dropout rate that you've mentioned, has a chance of being employed in the labor market about 70%. That's comparable to what we see in developed markets. So what needs to happen economically is that we need to have fundamental reforms that are market orientated, which unfortunately, again, I really do try to not sound like a broken record, but the government is not really trying to implement them at the stage.
Yeah, well, we can't help but sound like a broken record because the problem is the same one that it's been for a number of years, at least especially since GEAR has been abandoned, which is that government is embracing these incredibly stupid policies. And every time they fail, you know, going back to the manufacturing topic from earlier, you know, I think the first industry to really get hit with Ibrahim Patel's meddling was the textiles industry, because he, I think, came from a textiles union background. And all of a sudden, South Africa's textile industry was pretty much dead. And so he looked at what he had wrought and said, I think we should try that again. And that's how we got to the situation. Sarah, any final thoughts?
No, I saw from one of the comments that somebody recommending technical colleges and similar. And it's absolutely right. I mean, all over the world, there's University education is an elite thing in the sense that it involves a really small number of people relative to the society. And you've got to make it as easy as possible. Well, as easy as possible for people to succeed. And it includes, I mean, with regard to BEE, for example, BEE is punitive and it looks extensively at ownership, which doesn't really mean very much. I mean, you should be rewarding or finding some way to reward companies for employing people, just employing people. And then the larger the numbers of employment, at least people are starting to earn, and not only starting to earn, but if a youngster can get into an employment environment, unless they're very bad, it's you getting onto the ladder to learn to go up the ladder. I mean, this emphasis in society on, you know, well, you know, we've got to give special provision to the women and the youth. And, well, I mean, I don't go with those programs anyway. But the youth, with all due respect, and I was a youth once, you don't know much when you're a youth. You've actually got to have some experience in a job, in a business, before you can possibly even think of being suitable to create your own business. And the sooner we understand that the youth is, they're young, they're fresh, they're ready, they may even be eager, but they're not yet trained. They're not yet experienced. Without those opportunities, they go nowhere.
No, that's exactly right. And actually, I mean, government did have a policy for a time called the Youth Wage Subsidy, which was at least an attempt at putting more young people in the workforce, which was, I think, a financial incentive to businesses to employ young workers who had never had a job before. And despite the fact that it was officially government policy, it was never implemented due to the opposition of COSATU. And in a previous life, when I was a DA activist back in the day, I remember marching to COSATU House to demand that they stop opposing the youth wage subsidy, and we had bricks thrown at us. So I think that illustrates the problem quite well.
Because that's quite an interesting point. I mean, I blame COSATU for a lot. They've opposed all of the things that we say, you know, make labor law less rigid as far as entrance into the economy goes. I'm not sure I quite understand why they're so opposed. The law doesn't allow for their members to be retrenched just because newcomers have come in. If they've got experience, the newcomers are not going to be much of a threat to them anyway. There is very little threat, and by letting newbies come in, there's a greater pool of potential trade union members. So I don't get it. Maybe somebody can explain it to me, but I don't get it.
Indeed. All right. Let us move on to our last topic for today. And this is perhaps, in some ways, the most contentious topic that we're going to discuss today. But it is related to the suggested but not quite solidified plans about a vaccine passport. So a lot of countries around the world have been talking about, you know, restricting people who haven't been vaccinated from doing certain things. At the moment, most vaccine passport things are to do with either working in government across the world or traveling. And of course, the idea has been suggested here as well by President Cyril Ramaphosa. Now, key to this is going to be proof that one is vaccinated. So I think our Big Daddy Liberty's show, which you should obviously check out if you don't already, although I'm sure most of you probably have seen his content before, there's been a lot of discussion about the principle behind vaccine passports. But I just wanted to focus a little bit on the practicality here as to why, you know, this thing might not be such a great idea. And yesterday, the health department, unannounced, put up a button on its website saying, click here to get your digital vaccine certificate. So basically, this was a digital certificate which would say, you have been vaccinated at such and such a date, such and such a time. And there was no announcement to this. And so a lot of people kind of through rumor and social media rushed onto the website to try and get their vaccine certificate to prove that they in fact were vaccinated. And very quickly, the health department said, no, guys, we didn't mean to put it up. It was a test. Yeah, you shouldn't be accessing this. And so they quickly pulled it off their website. But not before some people managed to get themselves their vaccine certificates. Sarah? Am I just being pessimistic, or does this not particularly bode well for the implementation of any such policy?
Well, it doesn't strike me as I'm no technical expert, but it doesn't strike me as that difficult an issue to get right. But putting up a test, you know, when the issue is so hot as to whether you shouldn't have, what did it? Let's put it this way. If they could get it up, it's actually after that, it wouldn't be, by and large, the government's problem, because it's mostly the private sector that is deciding for itself whether or not to require a vaccine passport. The government need not say anything other than provide it, if it could provide it, that is, of course. They don't have to worry. I don't think the government has to worry about the controversy. It's more, well, I suppose, whether the government decides to call for the use of them for the public sector environment. But I think it's going to be led by the private sector, many of whom have already started saying we do want vaccine passport. And, you know, I don't want to get into the debate over whether it's good, bad, liberal, or illiberal, but I think that's really how it's going to pan out, provided that if they do create them, they can put them on the site and be accessed without further ado.
Yeah, I must say, I just can't see like a security guard at the front of Checkers not allowing you in, you know, unless you have your vaccine passport. I mean, even if that is company policy, I can't see it lasting more than about 20 minutes before everyone just gives up because it's too difficult.
When you see most private sector, it tends to be in the sort of what I call the head office environment where people are working constantly in close contact. I don't think it would be places like Pick and Pay, the store, because the masking, they haven't been shown to be huge spreaders of the disease, you know, over the period of the 18 months we've used. So I think as long as people use common sense about they applied, it may become less of an issue if they applied at all.
Becky, your thoughts in 30 seconds or so.
What immediately first came to mind as you mentioned the story, Nick, was actually a post posted by Sihle on his Instagram page where they recently opened up a soccer field as well as a rugby field in Eastern Cape worth 15 million. And it's just a field which is the stadium, which shouldn't cost more than, I don't know, more than 50,000, whatever the case is, but it cost 15 million. And it always comes to the case, whenever something is done by the government, it always is more expensive and it never works. And in regards to a vaccine mandate or vaccine passport, like I completely align with what Sara said. I think it's just an agreement between the employer and employee. It should definitely not be something that's enforced by the government. Even so, I don't think that the current government has any capacity to implement such a mandate.
No, exactly. Anyway, this is undoubtedly something we will return to as more and more comes out about this, probably next week. But with that said, we hope you enjoyed the show. We'll see you tomorrow on the Daily Fringe Show, and have an excellent and most wonderful day, everyone. Cheerio.